Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive function. This podcast is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. So join us as we explore executive function and the science of learning. And now, here's your host, the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome back to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. As you know, this podcast is fueled with many motivating and very important goals, which is to educate the listeners about executive function, its relevance to everyday life. Also, to kind of think about how do we take charge of our own selves and how do we guide ourselves so that our current self is helping the future self. And one such quality that comes to mind is patience. And often when you ask people, are you a patient person? Probably 90% of us will say, no, I'm not, right? And so we are going to dive deep today into that topic. You know, in the modern world of technological advancement, the waiting game is exclusively reserved for the losers, or sometimes it feels like that. So demonstrating patience is a sign of somehow resignation, or impatient existence is expected and sometimes even revered. Recently, I saw Jaden Smith's ad for the newest New Balance shoes, and he says, when you know what you want, waiting isn't an option. So having this clear notion that you should be goal driven, you should not wait, and you should, if you're waiting, there's something wrong with you, is something that the culture is propagating, and we somehow buy into it. Particularly us, those who are helping children, if they seem to take their own sweet time, demonstrate no urgency, or in fact have no focus, we unconsciously, as an observer, as a parent or a teacher or an educator, may have this urge to start something different and new so that our time is not wasted, right? So why do we feel so impatient? And is impatience and patience a science worthy of studying? Well, I will tell you, yes, it's a science worthy of attention of our guest today. So it's a great pleasure and honor to invite Dr. Sarah Schnitker. She's an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at Baylor University. She holds a PhD and an MA in personality and social psychology from University of California, Davis, and she has a bachelor's degree in psychology from Grove City College. She studies virtue and character development in adolescents and emerging adults, with a focus on role of spirituality and religion in virtue formation. I just love that, you know, there is a way to combine particularly two interests of mine and to find science behind it. She specializes in study of patience, self-control, gratitude, generosity, and thrift. So with a great joy, welcome to the podcast, Sarah. How are you?
I am well. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I asked this question of my guests, since we talk about executive function, before we jump into your work, can you talk a little bit about your own executive function skills and particularly patience when you were a child?
Yes. So as probably quite a few faculty are, I, in some ways, excel in executive function. So
imagine that.
Yep. Especially those more active forms of self-control, delay of gratification, persistence, sticking with a task, pushing ahead, getting it done. And as a child, that was always a really strong strength for me. I would say, though, my patience, like many people in this culture, was less of a strength. I did not like to wait. And really wanted to get it done and get it done now. And, you know, I think my most interesting part of my personal story is actually in my early 20s. That is when I really learned the value of patience. So I have some chronic health issues, something called cyclic vomiting syndrome, which is as horrible as it sounds.
Really?
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
It's pretty rare. Emerged when I was in graduate school in my early 20s. And It taught me that patience is a virtue that really matters alongside those more active, assertive forms of executive function. So really the value of learning to wait, learning to rest, to not push forward, to really listening to your own body, and being okay with delays. It was a really taxing time for me because I'm trying to get graduate work done. But also then getting really ill and having to figure out, do I push? But if I push, I'm going to make myself sicker tomorrow. Or do I wait, work a little less today, and then be able to sustain my productivity and my long-term goal pursuit? So it is something my health issues have forced me to actually practice. And this is, it's hard when you study something scientifically and then you're forced to actually try to do it yourself. I'm like, God, did I jinx myself? But I think that is such an important lesson to learn. And I'm really grateful in many ways that I got to learn that a little bit earlier in life. I think a lot of people don't learn it till kind of much later when they're aging and they start to see their body not do what they want it to do. Or even during our pandemic, as people have long COVID and are just having more and more kind of health issues that you can't just fix with a quick antibiotic treatment or something of that sort. So that is very much part of my story with patience as a part of executive function, is learning my own limitations and embracing them.
You know, so interesting. First of all, I'm grateful that you're better and, yes, and have learned to manage it, because it sounds like something you will have to continue to manage, yep, all your life.
It is.
So this is an interesting thing about patience, and I would love for you to maybe first define for us, mm-hmm, but I feel that patience is a virtue. However, mm-hmm, culturally, it gets kind of a bad rap.
It does.
It almost like it is equated to waiting. But what I understood from your work is it's a lot more than waiting.
Yeah.
And I do want, maybe you can make a cultural commentary. Why do we look down upon patience and not revere it as our ancient wisdom says we should?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, and David Bailey Harnett actually argues this, that since the Industrial Revolution, and I would say it's gotten even worse since the Information Revolution and our Technological Revolution, we have come as a culture to believe that any type of suffering or waiting means we failed. Our technology, yes, has failed us, and just through better technology and technological innovation, we can overcome all suffering or waiting. And there are some people who actually believe that will ultimately happen. So kind of the transhumanists actually do believe, yes, right? They're out there. They actually believe we will get rid of all suffering and waiting.
Yes.
But I think that's actually, there's not that many people that ascribe to that. And I think most humans, when they really sit back and think about it, the things that are most important in life, like deep relationships, spirituality, these things take time to develop. And that is actually part of our core human nature, is to learn to suffer well. And most religious systems, spiritualities have this as a component. Right? Buddhism, life is suffering, is one of the major tenets.
Yes.
And you also see this in the monotheistic traditions of suffering is something you do that other prophets have done before. And I think all of our, in our consumeristic society also pushes us towards this, that you have a problem, there's a solution you can purchase. instead of realizing sometimes when you have a problem, or a suffering or waiting, it really is a matter of you who has to change. and that there's actual dignity and growth that can happen through these hard experiences. And I think I mean, our medical system acts this way as well, right? We look for technological innovations for health and kind of forget about the whole person in the way we practice medicine and all kinds of things. So yes, it's very, very interesting how easy it is to buy into that philosophy that we failed if we have to suffer or wait or be frustrated. That's just not the case.
Unbelievable. So I think it just now reminds me that being fast, being productive, and being fast, being not just busy, but being really something at creating something substantial or achieving goals mm-hmm. by setting them out and working towards them is the narrative that we are really all about. So mm-hmm. our productivity is literally measured through actions and results, not patience as an actions.
Yes.
Action, because patience almost implies inaction.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So can you define it? What is patience?
Yeah. So patience is the ability to be calm in the face of frustration, adversity, or suffering. And when I talk about patience as a virtue, I say it's doing that for good reasons, for moral ends. So it is seeing that there is something worthwhile in the world. And as you are delayed in pursuing whatever this good thing is, you don't get inordinately saddened or depressed or angry or irritable as it takes time to get where you want to be. And we find with patients in our psychological research that for participants, I mean, sometimes it is really about waiting in line or waiting yes. in traffic, right? But that seems to be one particular type of patients, which we call daily hassles patients. And that kind of patients, I mean, does predict well-being outcomes, probably matters for your kind of physiological reactivity and your health. But as far as kind of other well-being outcomes, it's actually not as important as some of the other parts of patients. So we also see that there is a domain of patients we call interpersonal patients. And this is really important for relationship outcomes and for loneliness and how we are supported by others. So can I be patient with my spouse as for the 100th time he does the thing that drives me nuts, right? Or right
there. I have a big smile on my face because I recently saw a cartoon in the New Yorker where there was like, all the fireworks are going out at the dinner table when everybody's celebrating and saying, hey, you have finally said the joke 100 times, the yeah. same joke. So I can see totally having, particularly with your spouse and listening to that story, once again, as if it is brand new
yes.
and engaging in this pretend smile because you know other people haven't and you want to be respectful, but that requires a lot of patience, right? That's yep. interpersonal patience.
That's interpersonal patience. Then, and even another example, any parent knows yes. that interpersonal patience is required to parent well. Children yes. are their own human beings, even though we sometimes want them just to do what we want, to realize this is a human who, especially young children, is learning how to regulate their own emotions and doesn't necessarily have the language or other types of capacities that an adult has. And so how to interact and actually nurture good development in another human, that requires an incredible amount of patience when you're dealing with a temper tantrum or the same fight with your kid every day if they're an adolescent. It's that interpersonal patience is so essential, and it gives you that space. Doesn't mean you're never upset, but it gives you that space to respond and to actually be cognizant of how you're going to engage.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the third type of patients is the life hardships patients. And this is kind of the patients I was describing in my personal journey earlier of a long-term chronic illness that you will always have to deal with that might never resolve in this lifetime. Dealing with systemic racism across your entire lifespan and knowing hopefully we'll make progress, but it likely will not be fixed in this generation. So that kind of patients too is the kind alongside interpersonal patients that's really predictive of the psychological well-being outcomes. Being able to take that long view, knowing that you are going to have to continue in this suffering. So it's very...
So, you know, it's so interesting, as you were mentioning all three types of patients, and I definitely see the greatest rub is I'm much better with daily hassles and long-term. It's the interpersonal gets to me. And, you know, it reminds me of this beautiful poem that once I read. It's called And God Said No. I don't know if you've heard this
poem. I've not heard it.
So it says, I asked God to take away my pride and God said no. He said, it was not for him to take away, but for me to give up. I asked God to grant me patience and God said no. He said, the patience is a byproduct of tribulation. It isn't granted, it's earned. And I just love that because I think I almost feel each conflict-ridden situation where I exercise patience will guarantee that patience will continue throughout my life, and it doesn't. So is patience a process or is it a product? Is that even a good way to think about it?
I think you could think about it both ways. I tend to talk about patience development in my work, right? So you could think of it as a virtue. There's a product, there's an ideal form. But honestly, I don't think anyone's going to achieve that.
Yes.
We're human
beings.
Unless
you're a saint.
And even saints, you're like, oh, they weren't patient either. And so I think I like to think of the process of becoming more patient or becoming less patient. So I like to think of each person on a trajectory across their lifespan. And even moment to moment, are they cultivating and setting up their life in a way that can enhance their patience and help them to grow? Or are they in an environment, in a context they've created that actually is undermining their patience and decreasing their ability to practice this core strength of being a human? I tend to think about the process and kind of liabilities for patients and assets for patients' development.
I love that.
In our social environments, in our physical environments. Sometimes it's a matter of moving around things. So for example, I think a lot of us use our good old phones, right? Mine's right next to me. We've both got them right here. I think, I forget what the number was. The number of people who sleep with their phones in their bed is like way higher than you would hope. But sometimes phones can be great because they can help us pass time when we're waiting. But it also might be a crutch that you don't learn to just be calm and still and sit with the waiting. And so sometimes for myself, right, I'll be in a line or, you know what, I'm not going to get the phone out and look at the internet or check social media. I'm just going to sit and breathe for this moment and kind of practice this waiting. And I think, right, there's ways you can think about how you engage the world that can help you cultivate patience or undermine it.
You know, I think the real important thing you pointed out for me through the work that I kind of started reading your work is one, patient is a absolutely worthy virtue yes. to engage in. Absolutely worthy, rather than, because I used to think so much about productivity and, yeah. and really efficiency, and efficiency, pursuit of efficiency definitely made me more impatient because it's almost like a barrier to become efficient.
Right.
So showing patience is almost like not committing fully to goal attainment.
Right. Right.
So can you talk a little bit about, you have a great way to one measure it in a experimental setting,
yeah.
but also, this is such a good insight for people to cultivate.
Yes.
That patience also can be a parallel goal to pursue.
Yes.
Not just the goal that you're pursuing.
Right. So, and this is something kind of in my early work on patience, yes. I knew we had to address pretty quickly that there's these myths about patience. So I think so many people think patience is passivity, that
yes.
is just giving up, being lackadaisical, lazy. And it's interesting, a lot of my reading when I first started to look at patience was in philosophy or theology or these other disciplines, because we weren't looking at it very much in psychology at the time. And what I quickly realized is that in philosophy and theology, if you go back to kind of some of the older guys way back when, they actually, so like Aristotle has this idea of the golden mean in virtue development, that for virtues like patience, you can have a vice of excess and deficiency. So we typically think about the deficiency of patience. So not enough of it, and you're impatient, and you're reckless, and you're pushing forward and overly emotional, like just, right? We all know that feeling. But especially kind of the desert fathers and the Christian tradition really talked about, there's also too much patience, and that is a vice, that is not a virtue. So I...
Never is it like
know.
A sloth?
Yes.
Being
sloth
a
is so, and the word they would use is acedia or acedia, which is acedia. Translated as sloth. But it's more than like just laziness. It's also really disengagement, that you are so
apathy.
Apathy, right? Oh, you're really, you, and really what happens is the goal becomes so hard that you just give up, right? Mm. And we've seen that, right? Someone who, it's resignation that, you know what? Parenting this child through temper tantrums is too hard. I'm just going to let them
do whatever they want.
Whatever they want, and not try to actually help them grow well and develop their own emotional and self-regulation, right?
It's, yes.
Right. So patience is really at that golden middle where you don't become overly emotional and dysregulated. And you don't start to like lash out, but you also don't disengage, that you can sit with that discomfort and that not quite there yet, but still trying, and just kind of embrace that we're in the middle and we're not going to be done. we might suffer for a little while. I might continue to put up with the frustration. And so as I read about this idea, I said, okay, so scientifically then, when we look at patience, right, it should be distinct from assertiveness, and it shouldn't be associated with passivity. And that's indeed what we found in our early work, that the measure of patience we created, it actually was independent from assertiveness. So just because you're a patient doesn't mean you don't actually go and ask the person to do the right thing, or actually stand up for justice, or set boundaries with other people, right? So we would not call someone who is allowing them, their abusive boss at work, to continue to treat them poorly. If they're patient, they would be able to be calm during this, then maybe go talk to HR. So it is not separate from taking assertive action, but it is having kind of that equanimity and that presence of self to decide what to do instead of being emotionally driven to do something that you might regret, or to just disengage and allow that abuse to be heaped on you.
You know, it reminds me of this development of emotional agility. I mean, that there is that period where things are uncertain because you have to be patient for HR to do its filing of papers.
Yep.
And your boss continues to be obnoxious. Well, you have to tolerate that.
Yeah.
But you also don't want the boss to know you're complaining. So
right. It
is an incredible tense conditions in which you have to exert your patience. But apathy or disengagement will be, you know, this job doesn't matter anyways. Why bother? Or aggression would be to say and walk out on the job, right. Which you very much need.
Yes.
So it sounds like an incredible emotional maturation process.
Yes, exactly. And really, emotion regulation is such a key skill that I argue is one of the key things to develop to have patience. There's others as well, but that agility, the ability just to, first of all, be aware and identify your emotions. So
absolutely. Yeah,
you can't really start to regulate them if you don't even know what they are. And then to be able to practice kind of those different skills to help you regulate as you navigate these types of situations is really important.
And you know, I mean, I don't want to jump, but you will talk about how to kind of mitigate this problem with lack of patience. But one thing I have begun to notice that, for example, when you witness other people's lack of patience, it reminds you so clearly about how the patience can be valuable to them to relate to you.
Yes. But
you do not necessarily honor them with your own patience. There are lots of benefits. Your work kind of shows incredible benefits of patients. Can you walk us through those benefits?
Yes. So, I mean, we find it's related to so many things, positive affect, life satisfaction, hope, self-esteem, regulated behaviors. You were mentioning goal pursuit earlier. And actually one of our studies, studies we're conducting right now, we actually looked at this idea as like, is patience going to undermine your goal pursuit? So as a person who's patient on particular goals, are they actually going to fall prey to the sloth, acedia, just not progress and move forward? And we actually found that is not the case. So in one study, we looked at college undergrads across a quarter of their academic semester. And ask them, okay, for this semester, what 10 goals are you working on? And then we ask them all kinds of questions about each of those goals. So how patient are you in the pursuit of goal one, goal two, goal three? How much effort are you exerting? How meaningful is this goal to you? And how much achievement are you experiencing on this goal? And we followed up with them every 2 weeks. And what we found is that across time, when people were more patient, they actually exerted more effort 2 weeks later. So it really seems, and they actually had more achievement. And there were these even bi-directional relationships. So you're patient, you exert more effort allows you to be more patient. And so it was really exciting to see this process play out that, contrary to, I think, some of our gut intuitions as people in the United States and probably other Western contexts, that patience will undermine your effort, it actually facilitated that goal pursuit process. And we're finding this now as well with our lab, some studies. My grad student, Juliet Ratchford, is going deeper and creating more robust measures for these kind of goal pursuit studies. And we even find that patients, how people pursue their goals with patience really is negatively correlated with their more reckless pursuit and also correlated with less passivity. So we're really seeing the theory play out in how people pursue their goals, which I think it's just really helpful for me because, right, I love to pursue goals and be efficient and to say, no, stop. actually over-efficiency is bad. That using patience, even though I think it's good in its own right, but it also actually helps with the long-term other goals I care about. And that my gut intuition is wrong and pushing ahead too far is not going to help me.
You know, as I was listening to you, you know, I grew up in India, and part of history lessons of course, India's effort to gain independence from Commonwealth, and Mahatma Gandhi's, you know, Ahimsa movement, the nonviolence movement, was such a symbolic of this process that you're talking about. And it absolutely was, I mean, of course, every part, you know, whether we did literature or history or, you know, community service, this was like a common theme. And it just made so much sense. Culturally, there is a great emphasis on patience. But one thing that stands out as you are talking about this is this idea that it's not inactive. It is full engagement. It is also kind of your incredible emotional even keelness. Kind of, I think it creates incredible unrest in other person because they have never exercised it. They have used aggression to counter you and kind of intimidate you. Or when they see you don't back down, but you're not aggressing, it actually makes you absolutely uncomfortable to look like a horse's ass because you are just odd and weird to respond to somebody's calmness with aggression. So it kind of promotes introspection in the other person. And so I'm wondering, as you're talking about this, the patience that you're demonstrating in the process of goal pursuit, particularly multiple goals that you're pursuing, this almost reminds me of Kristen Neff's work of self-compassion.
Yes.
Right? Yes. Like you're saying, I'm not going to aggress towards on me for not accomplishing all the goals at one time. But at the same time, I'm going to have incredible respect for myself, for the decent ambition I have for myself.
Exactly. I think that work, I know I personally use that often, but I think, right, that's one of those ingredients of, can I be patient with myself? And you have to have compassion with kind of these interpersonal forms of patience. That really helps if you empathize, and we can direct that towards ourselves as well. Only a human.
Yes.
This is unreasonable. Expectation that as a human being, I would be able to continue forward without rest. Humans must sleep. Humans must.
Yes.
Right. I mean, and that is, I think, such an interesting cultural phenomena that we almost want humans to be robots and to not have human needs. One of my colleagues at Baylor University, Michael Scollin, is a sleep researcher. And it's just great to always have him in the room and be like, sleep is so important for the brain. Like,
I know.
Just pushing sleep constantly because, right, even when you sleep, which seems like you're not doing anything at all, your brain is doing so much. And there's so many functions that happen during that non-active time of your day where memory is consolidated, where insight can be gained. And I think it's more of a respect for these less agentic feeling forms of activity to realize there are other forms of activity that our bodies and our minds do. That are not quite as agentic, but are so important and are not passive just because we aren't kind of pushing them forward.
Have you studied influence of one's own patience on other people cultivating the same for themselves?
We have not. I would love to do that. I think it would be so fascinating to do kind of like almost a social network analysis. So
yes.
Right. Because we do find this like with other virtues, like gratitude. That, like,
yes.
You can create this upward spiral in a group. So I start expressing gratitude to my spouse, that builds bonds. They might actually start expressing it back to me, and you kind of have this upward spiral. I expect, I would hypothesize that we would see that with patients. So, right? Spouse is a great example here. I start to be, I'm more patient with my spouse. They will notice that, right? And it might start to be reciprocated, and they will be less reactive. And it's really interesting. I don't know if you or your listeners are familiar with, like, with John Gottman's work on marriage, right? And his work is all about the emotions and how we regulate our emotions in conflict and do that with our partners.
The emotional contagion, we just pick up the energy.
And so, right, when each person can have, if you can work on cultivating your own patience, that can really change the whole dynamic of how we engage with kids too. I've seen it with my own child. And especially, I think, for many parents during the pandemic, right?
You're like,
we are with each other all the time. Right, realizing when I realize my patience is thin in a particular moment, sometimes it helps to just even name. I know with my daughter, like, even when she's 3, 4, she's 5 now, like, I will say, like, mommy's having trouble being patient right now. I might need you to help me, that I need to step back. And just using that language, I think, can really help, because we have a higher order goal that we're both, it's not me versus you, it's we're both trying to be patient with each other. And having this kind of language can be really helpful for those moments.
I noticed that, you know, with my son called me using FaceTime, and he wanted to learn one Indian recipe. And he was holding the camera. This is literally nothing big, okay? It was not even about the recipe, but the way he was holding the camera was half the pan was not in the view. And I saw myself getting so annoyed with the way he was holding the camera. And I completely lost the perspective that here is a young man trying to cook. He called and he wanted to actually learn something instead of just kind of, you know, offering that support and just learning opportunity. Here I was criticizing the camera holding, which is something very hard when you're cooking. And so I just told him, can you call me back in 2 minutes?
Yeah.
And then I got up, I washed my face, and I took the FaceTime again. And I said, I'm going to try being very patient. And it literally changed. Didn't matter how he held the camera. I just said, when you have a moment, can you adjust the camera? And boom, you know, it changed the way we interacted with each other. So I cannot have this conversation without you kind of helping us. So how can we build our patience?
We can.
In ourselves and in our children. And particularly adolescents.
We can. That is good news. Absolutely. We can build patience. This is the good news of all this. And I mean, we weren't sure when we started, right? We, as a scientist, I want to see, it could be that patience was something some people just have and others don't. But I had an inkling early that, no, I think this is something you can cultivate, because you see throughout history that there are people who have intentional practices in their life, and those seem to be working for them, and somehow they become more patient. So it's a lot of our early work, right, wanting to see, are there interventions, are there activities that we can do to build patience? And across our studies, I find, I kind of have, they're not easy steps, but kind of three steps I've identified that I use often to think about how to build my patience. And how others can as well. So I call it the identify, imagine, and sync as the three steps. So identify, we mentioned this earlier, just identify is about first realizing what I am feeling. So in your example of the camera being off center, to realize I'm frustrated right now. And I'm frustrated because this stupid camera is not centered and
it's not showing me the pot.
It's not showing me the pot. Like, right. And once you name that and identify it, that in itself takes you a step back and says, what's going on here? And you might even, it sounds like you reflected, like, this is maybe a little silly that I'm so upset about this. So then what you want to say is, then let's now imagine this situation in a different way. So we know what's happening. I'm getting frustrated. And I heard you do this even in your example of, well, I can reappraise the situation. It's really hard to cook and hold a camera. Like, let's think about this from the other person's perspective. So engage in some perspective taking or imagine kind of what are the benefits of this. So really, we call this in psychology cognitive reappraisal and learning to think about the situation in a new way that will help to alleviate the emotional burden of the situation. And there's a lot of research showing this is one of the most effective ways to regulate emotions. But then that third step of thinking, it's thinking with your purpose. This is the step I think a lot of people forget.
Yes.
And this is something I think you need to do even outside of when you're frustrated. So something we need a reason to want to be patient. So we can identify our emotions. We can do reappraisal, imagine the situation differently. But why am I even trying? Right? So we need a higher order purpose that provides deep motivation. So with your son, it would be
kind of loving him, maybe.
Right. I have a purpose as a parent to cultivate him, help him develop his executive function, to make him a contributing human being to society. For some people, their purpose even involves spiritual activities to help him know and love God or be part of the higher order of the universe, right? There's these higher levels of meaning that those can be really diverse for what those are. So some people it's in traditional faith and religious traditions. For some people, it's very much personal spirituality, but we all are spiritual people. And maybe it's about environmental. I mean, we all have these really big ultimate concerns in life. And what we find is that, and we're still testing this, how this works exactly. We don't have it all figured out with our science, but the theory is that when you're able to activate on a regular basis these higher order purposes and then connect them to your daily suffering and your interpersonal encounters and your long-term life hardships, this gives you kind of that that energy to keep sustaining the practice of patience. So
can I ask you a question about this particular step? It's so important because I think this cannot be activated until you have some regulation of your emotion.
Yes.
Because if you're losing your marbles, you cannot really see a purpose. The purpose is to get angry and school that person, right? I mean, I was so hung up on the camera blocking the pot, which if I didn't see, I couldn't help him. And I was getting a little righteous that, look, here I am to help you and you can't even help me to help you. You know, I mean, I was getting all that, which is such a tiny example. But is this purpose, I mean, I can see the layers of purpose, you know, like I can take aerial perspective on my own life and its meaning. I can take a perspective as a mother who's trying to help young man cook. I could say I'm a decent human being who should be helping people because it's their need, or I should be just a nice person and not be such a witch and for a small situation, right? So which kind of purpose should I be activating, or is there like a distinction between these purposes?
And I think this is an area where you need to research. I think I think a key point here is when you try to do this. So with patience, I talk about training and not trying. So I think we want, when I think about the process of developing patience, I encourage people not to wait until they're upset. Instead, have moments or habits or practices throughout your daily life where you take time to try these out and do them before you get upset. So, for example, a common religious practice or spiritual practice people have is pausing before a meal to either engage in prayer, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, it could also just be pausing to be thankful for kind of just in general to the other people who prepared this, to the animals and plants that gave up their lives for this meal, for, I mean, to the people who grew the crop. Like, so there's like, this is something we do in our family and it has religious overtones, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
And we actually say, this is a practice we're going to intentionally include in our lives, that when we sit down to eat, we aren't going to start until we've engaged in this practice. And first of all, for a kid, they want
to have the food,
right? The food is there. Can I start? Right. But saying nope. First of all, that's a practice of waiting and you have to regulate, but also to connect it to the bigger things in this world and to say we are grateful to God or to these, this thing that's bigger than ourselves. So I think the defining feature here is it needs to be something beyond the self. We call that transcendent. So not just, right, needs to be connecting you to something bigger. And that is really potent. So I think finding ways and intentional practices to do this regularly, where you're reminding yourself there's something bigger at play that, yes. Or even like in a relationship, like with a child, like I know for us, it's that bedtime and the tuck-in of calling out the importance of why we're together and talking to my kid about, I'm proud of the way you were patient today. And mommy really loves you for who you are. And like, so incorporating these daily practices into life and even doing that in community. So this is one of the things I think religion and our, my study of religion provides well, is it provides a lot of structure. So for example, in Islam, there's also seasonal activities. So in Ramadan, when there is this whole multiple weeks of fasting throughout the day and then breaking that fast when the sun goes down, and having spiritual special prayers and activities to really think about what does it mean to practice waiting to eat and drink. And we do that together. And how does this connect us to our higher purpose? It's, we have data right now. We are analyzing it as we speak. Postdoctoral researcher, Merve Balkaya Inche, in Ramadan this past year, we actually conducted an experience sampling study with adolescents. So that means so three times a day, we pinged them as they were fasting or breaking their fast and looked at kind of how patient are you right now? And what kind of spiritual practices have you engaged in and what's going on? So trying to really look at this process in the moment of how engaging in the spiritual practice of Ramadan and all the spiritual practices that are part of that, how that changes you and builds your patience and changes your gratitude. And I think there's some real richness provided by various spiritual traditions to do this well, and right, it's doing it ahead. It's not waiting till you're angry with your spouse. It's trying to give yourself the opportunity to build this muscle of patience and doing the workouts. So that way, when you need that strength in the moment, when your emotions are high and you're hot, you want to just scream, you've practiced. So you're ready for it.
Oh, that's so brilliant. You know, I grew up in India and my mom lives with me, and I've mentioned her many times on my podcast, but she fasts at least 2 days a week.
Yeah.
And 3 days sometimes. And I fast once a week, and one time a week, my husband and I, we take no food, and we fast together. Mm-hmm. And Yes, those kinds of bonding mechanisms mm-hmm. of just having this understanding you're going into this day mm-hmm. and you will not be consuming food is a, mm-hmm. it's such a good understanding. So mm-hmm. if you are feeling hungry, you know the solution is you will not eat. and that kind of having clarity really helps, because it's not that you're hungry and then you start looking for food and you get irritated. Which is what most often mm-hmm. happens to me when I'm hungry. And then my husband reminds me that you haven't eaten only for 4 hours. So just chill. but as you were thinking about this, a story comes to my mind. You know, when my son was 10, he and I went to Barnes & Noble because Lemony Snicket, you remember him?
Yes.
In a series of unfortunate events.
Yeah.
So he was coming to sign his seventh book. That was all the rage in my house. And we waited. We went there after school at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we didn't get his book. He didn't sign the book until 1 a.m. And so this young, you know, my son, who was only 10 years old, was so amazingly patient. We didn't get to eat. We just stood in line. There was no food there. We looked through the aisles and we had amazing books. And fast forward, 10 years later, when he was in college, he went to, Columbia in New York City, and Saturday Night Live tickets were going to be, they were going to be available. And then he and his friends stood in line in the middle of winter for 23 hours, and they got the ticket. So I feel like, okay, good. You know, sometimes patience can actually help you if you have cultivated it mm-hmm. over time, and it can become a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It can become something that you learn to wait for good things and teach yourself to entertain yourself, you know, kind mm-hmm. of figure out ways to create a little, a little protective layer on the streets when you're sleeping mm-hmm. the night there, you know? So yeah, I think you make such a good point that it should be training, not trying. Really think it's a profound statement. So Sarah, thank you for your amazing insights. Before we end this conversation, you are an inspiration. So I'm curious, what is it that you're reading recently that has inspired you, or you recommend that our readers explore it as well?
Well, so the book that got me into all of this work is a book by David Bailey Harned called Patience, How We Wait Upon the World. This is how I got into it as a grad student. I had just started with Bob Emmons at UC Davis, and I was getting ready to go home for Christmas break, and he hands me this book. He says, you should read this. This could be interesting. No one's looking at this. And he's a Christian moral philosopher, and just makes this argument of how we have abandoned patience in our society. And he talks particularly about Christian theology and philosophy, but it's broader kind of for a lot of Western culture, and especially the U.S. So I think that's a really interesting work, kind of seeing the history of how this was much more important and kind of fell out of favor. Another book I really enjoy on patience, well, it's kind of on one of the vices that we talked about. It's called Acedia and Me, or Acedia and Me, by Kathleen Norris.
Oh, wow.
And she really connects kind of the spiritual aspects of this disengagement, sloth, disenchantment with the world, and helps us think about how patience can help us stay engaged spiritually, stay engaged in quest for justice and goodness and love. And it's just a really kind of personal journey she has with some of this kind of struggles with this feeling of ennui or acedia, but also some really wonderful reflections spiritually. That I think, she writes come from more of a Catholic tradition. But I think really transcend a variety of spiritualities it's just really lovely work.
Beautiful. Well, I have, I ordered the first book that you told after listening to you and your reading about mm-hmm. your approach to your work, but I have not read Kathleen Norris's book, so that's going to be on my list. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And if you loved what you heard, please share this episode with your friends, your family, and spread the joy and invite them to cultivate the habit and this virtuous quality of patience together. I can only imagine if all of us make this commitment, what a beautiful world we will create for ourselves. So thanks again for joining us today for this wonderful conversation, and stay tuned until the next episode. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. To contact your host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive function, visit her website at exqinfiniteknowhow.com. That's www.exqinfiniteknowhow.com. Tune in next week for another informative episode of Full Prefrontal, hosted by the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.